We're ready for argument in the case of French versus the people. The petitioner may proceed.
Good morning, Chief Justice Malarkey and fellow members and justices of our fine and great state. My name is David Michael Corey. I'm the attorney representing Scott Michael French, who was charged with violation of the computer crime statute as well as the securities fraud statute that is the subject matter of this appeal. I'd like to preface my remarks with a couple of little comments. I graduated from law school in 1973, University of Colorado, I'm proud to say, and I was first admitted to this bar in 1973. I find that as I practice, there's certain things that happen in your life that are remarkable as an attorney. And one of those remarkable things I want to share with the court and our students, and that is the fact that as you go through life, here you are, in my case, almost 40 years of practice, and you come into a case or you come into a situation that essentially takes you back to what you learned in school. This is one of those remarkable cases, and this is how I want to sort of share this. The real gist in the issues in this case is this. Was there sufficient evidence presented for a jury to find Mr. French guilty of computer crime and securities fraud? Now, the essence of this case being a criminal case essentially is this. Was there a crime? Was there evidence? If so, the jury's verdict should be sustained because this was a jury trial. Now, I had the pleasure of being not only the appellate attorney in this case, but I actually tried the case. And we had a district court judge that worked very hard. It was a complex case. It went for weeks. Our record on the case is 43 volumes. We've got binders, exhibits. It takes a forklift to almost move the record in this case. But I lived this case. The trial court lived the case. The jurors lived the case. Everybody worked hard on the case. But ultimately, the case before your honors is this. It's essentially a property law case. I remember taking property as one of my first courses in law school, and we were taught essentially that property amounted mostly to setting up boundaries, and essentially by having boundaries, you either were inside the boundary or you were outside the boundary. In this particular case, Mr. French was found guilty of computer crime under our law, which essentially requires, as written, as interpreted by People versus Rice, People versus Robb, of requiring some use, some interaction by the defendant with the computer. Essentially, if we considered computer crime as a box, a property boundary, to be guilty of computer crime, Mr. French had to have done something where he crossed the boundary and got inside the box. Now, the people in their opposition brief to the brief we filed with this court, at page 11 of their brief, which I know the court is aware, conceded that Mr. French, though found guilty of computer fraud by the jury, that verdict being sustained by the trial court, that in fact Mr. French never used a computer. The essence of the people's arguments are this, that there was evidence in the trial that somehow or another Mr. French benefited by the use of someone else's use of a computer in generating certain documents that were part of an alleged securities fraud that were used in the generation of commission checks and other things, but the facts are just not there to show that Mr. French was inside the box. And I want to put this in context. I took a different role in being an appellate counsel here. In order to be a good appellate counsel, I felt what I needed to do was I needed to go back and review my own work and look through 43 volumes, look through every exhibit, every document.
Mr. Corey?
Certainly.
I think fundamentally their argument is that he made use of the resources of the computer in various ways, and that he did so knowingly, and that fits under the statute. And they make an argument about statutory construction, which at least has some superficial appeal, which is that the definition of use details a lot of actual touching and handling of a computer, which your client didn't do. But on the other hand, the resource, it says or, making use of a resource. So we're really talking about the output of a computer. And then secondly, it seems that that statute was changed to make the word access, which indicates to me that the legislature was making a change and narrowing it from what it was at the time that you went to trial. So why didn't he use resources of computer and generating the brochure and other sorts of things, which I think you probably admit?
Justice Bader, you actually have two questions there, if I could.
Sure.
The first question is, did Mr. French make use of a computer, and did that essentially equate to a violation of the computer? I'm sorry.
Use of the resource
of the computer.
Right.
The response to that is that the record in this case does not show that Mr. French made use of the resource, the distinction being this. In People versus Robb, the Court of Appeal made the decision or the distinction that Mr. Robb did not give information that was input into the computer.
Mr. Corey, let me just interrupt you. I don't disagree with your reading of your co-defendant's case. But to be candid with you, we certainly can reconsider that issue.
I
would appreciate it if you'd address the specific issue. I mean, you're right, certainly, about the argument from Rob, but I don't think that's going to get you there.
And thank you for telling me that, Justice. Our time's too precious for me to go down an avenue that's not productive. To make use of the resource of a computer, if I could go back to property laws, my underlying argument is this. When we charge people under a criminal statute, and we tell them you're going to be held liable and responsible, the conduct as defined has to have some reasonable nexus to the activity of the person. The making of use or the resource of this particular, in this particular case, the only evidence at trial was that somehow or another Mr. French benefited by someone else's use of the computer in producing the brochure and the other documents. Now, benefiting from somebody else's use is different than using by the statute, and even under the interpretations we've talked about, and I'd suggest this court would be better served by pronouncing a decision that creates a reasonable boundary for people who are charged with computer crime to have some basis to ascertain what the prohibited conduct would be. It's just better policy, Justice Bender. I can't put it in a better way. Because if we took it to the next step and we said make use of the resource of a computer, we literally would have a computer crime statute that would cover everything we do. We essentially, for example, I came here today, as the court may be well aware, my office is in Las Vegas, Nevada. I got on an airplane. I had to use essentially somebody input some information in a computer for me to get a boarding pass. Somebody put information in a computer for me to get a rental car slip. In fact, somebody even put something in the computer when I stopped at my alumni to buy a T-shirt.
None of which you're trying to perpetuate a fraud. Here's a person in California who's got to know, being the boss, and the allegation is perpetuating a fraud through the use of the computer, that his subordinates are going to make contact, distribute information in pursuit of the fraudulent scheme. So why doesn't it fit right within that four corners of the language of the statute?
Taking my analysis, if I could, with your permission, the fact that then I do use a computer to get a boarding pass and a ticket, then I walk in and I rob a liquor store. Am I using a computer because I somehow or another traveled on the airplane and went in and robbed the liquor store? I'd suggest that.
Well, wait a second. You would admit that the Green brochure had untrue misstatements of fact, right?
There's no issue. There's substantial evidence.
So he indirectly used the Green brochure in obtaining, and through his salespeople, obtaining others, consumers, to make an investment, right?
That's an issue that's factual.
I understand that.
No, but Justice Bender.
I understand that's a securities fraud issue, but I'm going to focus on computer crime for a minute.
Well, no, please do, but see, the problem with the record is that there's no indication that Mr. French did anything like that. All Mr. French's total tie to any activities was the fact that he was identified as being the office manager. In fact, the facts of the case.
You mean there's no evidence that he knew that they were using the Green brochure?
None.
Zero?
None. The bizarre part about this case, the way the record is before the court, is this. The Capital Funding Group, which was the group that directed the printing of the green brochure and directed the sending it out, actually had salespeople in offices all over the country. He was identified as the manager. There was nothing to show that he initiated the sending of the green brochure. It came out from capital funding. The salesman would request it. There was nothing to indicate he had done anything to generate the green brochure.
What about
nothing
awareness? What about just knowledge of the green brochure? The statements contained in it.
But
were there evidence of that?
That's taking the benefit of it, but that's not necessarily using it or making use of the resource, and that's the distinction.
How did he get the benefit if it weren't from the money that the green brochure has generated?
Without a doubt, that there is evidence that he got the benefit of money that this particular whole, let's just call it a whole scheme, if we want to call it another word. But the problem with that is that in order to get there, to make him recipient of the benefit of this particular activity, you have to charge him, his charges needed to be as a conspirator. There had to be complicity.
Can we just for a second explain to the audience that there's been complicity and conspiracy? Just explain.
Oh, certainly, absolutely. The concept of the conspiracy complicity theory is that if you are engaged in some type of criminal conspiracy where somebody else is the active player and you've agreed with them, or they're acting as your agent, or you're aiding and abetting them, that in essence you become liable. In other words, let's assume that I asked Ms. Berman, who's my worthy opponent here, to go out and commit a crime, and I handed her a gun to help her do it. I didn't necessarily go out and commit the crime. Heaven forbid she wouldn't, obviously. But if she would, I would be liable to her as a conspirator. Aider and abetter, complicity, all of those things. I could get the benefit of it. For example, Mr. French.
Well, wait a minute. In this case, the jury acquitted him of conspiracy, right?
They
dismissed it.
Justice Bender, the state dismissed the conspiracy charge. So what we
and
have.
Aiding and abetting was never given to the jury. So
never
so
was.
The jury was never instructed on whether or not your client aided and abetted the fraud.
Was not.
Okay.
So the real issue, again, Justice Bender, comes down to this. In defining the statute and the case at best against Mr. French, he got the benefit of some of these activities, but the record doesn't show he directed. The record doesn't show he interrelated with a computer.
Does it show that he was aware of the green brochure, for example, or not?
It doesn't even show that. That's the troubling part. The one tie, now the court, I suggest the court remember this. This is a huge criminal case, 14 defendants. I mean, this is like a party. All this evidence is coming in. We go back and we take a look at it and we say, what is really tied to Mr. French? And I want to jump to my second argument because you took me right into it with your permission. Well,
before you go there, certainly. I would like to hear you conclude your distinction that you're trying to make between use and benefit. I gather in the example of your traveling to get here, the point was you benefited from the computer, but you did not make use of it. You tossed two words out there, but where's the line between those?
I think
What would you have to have done in order to use instead of benefit?
The make use of the resource of computer, the suggestion I would have would be all the cases that have sort of preceded this one, and that would be that the perpetrator of the crime has to have some inter-involvement or interrelation with the computer itself. Otherwise, it sort of expands the computer fraud statute way beyond reason.
So you're talking about touching it, actually?
No. Justice Martinez, giving data into it. For example, somebody keying in on a telephone pad, somebody going onto the internet, somebody directing somebody to say, go in and use this computer. Somebody saying, here's a computer, this is what we're going to do with it.
Would somebody directing suffice, even in a case such as this, where complicity was taken out of the case?
Without complicity in the case, directing probably wouldn't get there unless there was something more. There would have to be something to tie the person to some rational relationship with the computer where the person is actually directing, scope, control, something physically interreacting. If we take the computer fraud case to its logical extreme, unless we have a boundaries of something where you interrelate in some manner, the person, the criminal, the actor, then we're in a society now, everybody that has any crime is going to be guilty of computer fraud. So that's why I was just talking about the property law boundaries. I just think the court, I'd urge the court to consider just the practical reality of having a statute that has meaning. And if we expand it beyond that, if it's benefits, then the statute really has no meaning. And one other thing, if I could, Justice Bender, I think an argument could be made that when the statute was revised from the time that my client was charged, the 98 statute, to the 2008 where the term access was used, that arguably access may have broadened it as opposed to the reverse. And I know, for example, in the Court of Appeals decision upholding the trial court here, the Court of Appeals decision actually referenced the wrong statute. They referenced in its opinion the 2008 statutes about assessing. I brought that to the attention of this court with some other things, and I'm happy to say I'm here. And it's an important public policy issue, is this computer fraud, because assuming that this intent of the legislature was to narrow it to the access a little bit, if that was the intent to narrow that, arguably it's broadened it, it still requires to have some common sense application that somebody has to do more than just benefit by the use of it. And that's just what I suggest. Now, shifting over, if I could, did I answer your question, Justice Martinez?
Just let me hold you 1 second. Just certainly. You've dwelt heavily on the complicity conspiracy problem. Let me just ask you, do you think it's necessary to charge complicity as a theory?
Oh, here it had to be charged. If they were going to get a conviction on Scott French,
So are you saying it was a defective charge if he was convicted and the only evidence supported a complicity theory?
Absolutely. And
well, wait a second. Let's clear up something. You charge complicity by charging someone as a principal.
Right.
You instruct the complicity or the aiding and abetting instruction. But are you admitting that there was sufficient evidence for aiding and abetting in this case?
Probably not, but the conviction could stand in no instances here unless there was something that was charged as a complicity argument. It just couldn't stand. Once the people made the election to not charge the conspiracy in the case, and there were a lot of reasons for him to do that, Your Honor, a lot, because as the court is aware with these multi-defendant cases, with a conspiracy charge, then you've got all the issues as to whose statements are admissible to who, what discovery we can get, what comes in, whether or not we're entitled to a separate trial under fundamental fairness. So they made a decision to not charge it, and yet they wanted to try that case. They essentially wanted to say somebody else is used making a green brochure.
I guess what I'm asking here is we've abandoned the notion of different persons to a crime. Right, we no longer have principals and the principal and accessories. We have a complicity instruction. Are you suggesting that it is essential that the jury that the crime be charged in such a way as to distinguish those acts that are done as a complicitor as opposed to those acts that are not done as a complicitor?
I don't,
but would satisfy the crime?
Your Honor, I don't think that's the rule of law, but in this case, the decision was made to not charge as a conspirator. And as
wait, you're getting into conspiracy. Let's stick with complicity.
Right. I just suggest to this, actually you've got me in a little bit of a ball because I equate in my mind, because I guess I'm old and old-fashioned, that conspiracy and complicity are an overlapping concept. And I know that
requires an agreement.
Right. And complicity.
Doing an unlawful act.
Right.
And complicity is aiding and abetting.
Exactly. Yeah, complicity is aiding and abetting. He wasn't charged with aiding and abetting, wasn't charged as a conspirator. So the jury was not given instructions to make findings against Mr. French under this theory, under this charge of computer crime, under either of those theories. Without those instructions, the jury didn't have a way to find him guilty of those charges.
But they did find him guilty, and the question is whether there was sufficient evidence. Are you suggesting that we could not consider evidence that would be sufficient if we felt that it amounted to only evidence of the crime under a complicity theory, unless the jury was expressly instructed?
I don't think I'd be well-founded to make that argument, and I agree with you. You make a very good point. But I would suggest this. There wasn't evidence of complicity here, even. Okay. Other than all there was an evidence, the best evidence to the people, the absolute best, was that Mr. French got a benefit. That there was money generated, that he got a benefit. And even that was tenuous because it went to the corporate entities, and there was one statement by somebody that said we equated the corporate entities with Mr. French. So arguably the best evidence for the people would be that he got the benefit, but it still comes to the benefit. Because the rest of the record just doesn't show French as doing anything else other than having that title. And I and thank you that you raised some very good points. I hope I was able to answer them.
Thank you.
Now, just shifting over to the second issue, which I think is a very interesting one, maybe more of a legal interesting. As the court's aware, under the securities fraud charge, Mr. French was charged with securities fraud in basically conduct of business, which he was acquitted on. He was found guilty of securities fraud as to one sale with a gentleman by the name of Mr. Fomento. The issue that we raised at trial, and we raised here again in our appeal, is this. The only link with Mr. French and Mr. Fomento that's in the record that was presented to the jury was that Mr. Fomento stated he called Mr. French. They had one telephone conversation. This is the total record from the 43 volumes. Mr. Fomento testified, so did you speak with somebody called Scott French? Answer, I did. What type of information did he give you? Answer, you know, he answered some of our questions about what the company was doing, where it was going, how things were going to work, that sort of thing. It was sort of, you know, a good roads, fair weather type of conversation. It was all upbeat. Now, our contention, Your Honors, is basically this. And I'm taking you back to a case that really, first of all, addressed this, which was People versus Blair. And the essence of People versus Blair, which was this court's decision, was that in taking a look at the specific type of a securities fraud charge, such as this one, which is a direct sale to somebody, or indirect sale, as it were, that at some point in time, there are limits that have to be considered as a matter of law with the transaction the court has to say there's just limits. There's a point in time when, hi, it's a nice day, blue skies, fair weather, does that constitute a sale? In the context of this case, we're suggesting to the court that it's not, once again, it's outside of this box that we described, the property boundary box, because here we had a salesman, Dan McGrath, who spoke with Mr. Fomento 5 or 6 times, arranged for the green brochure to be sent to Mr. Fomento, which Mr. French had nothing to do with. Mr. Fomento actually went to the corporate headquarters in Denver of Cap Funding, met with Mr. Severson, who was a principal of Cap Funding, made his decision to buy based on what McGrath told him, the green brochure and everything else. The only nexus that Mr. French had to securities fraud, the only nexus was the one conversation. Now, the people admit that. The people admit that it was the one conversation. They argue some federal case law, which we can talk about. Many of those cases are sort of...
Mr. Corey, what about indirect control as his boss?
The issue there is an interesting one, because once again, we talk about People versus Blair, Justice Bender, which kind of talks about that.
Well, that's distinguishable on its facts, because he talked to the salespeople directly.
He did,
but
yes.
But here, what was the evidence that indicated that McGrath was following basically his instructions as he was the boss?
There was none. In fact, Justice Bender, it was a reverse. The evidence in this case was that each salesperson was given a script by Cap Funding out of Denver. The script was actually supervised by a compliance officer by Cap Funding. They were directed as to what they could say. Nobody could vary from the script. Everything was controlled and directed from Cap Funding. The only thing we have, Mr. French, once again, is the title of being the office manager. There's no evidence. There's nothing where, no evidence where somebody says, French told McGrath to say this. French gave him the green brochure. French told him, this is what you have to do. French supervised him. All we have is having that title. And I agree, Justice Bender, there's an inference, since he's the office manager, he's a supervisor. I mean, that's an inference that the people kind of rode the horse off into the sunset on. But the facts are the facts, and you can call a rose, or it can be a pear, but it's still what it is. In this particular case, all we have is French identified as being the office manager, these ISOs. Everything else, control, direction, everything was done out of Denver through Cap Funding. And literally, this is one of those unusual cases where the record overwhelmingly supports our argument that the office manager title, that's all it was. It meant nothing. The record.
Counsel, if I could interrupt you.
Certainly, Justice Rice.
I haven't looked at the record, but I have read the briefs, and opposing counsel makes reference to one more conversation with Mr. French. And according to the brief, at least, in this conversation, Mr. French said that the first affiliates were just breaking even. We were going to start making money. And I think at that point, we were only about a year old, or we were about a year old. Now, that would be a material misrepresentation, no doubt about it. Isn't that correct?
Justice Rice, if you look carefully at that portion of the transcript, that's not what Mr. Fumeno said. Mr. Fumeno indicated that he had the one conversation with French, but all of those remarks are attributed to Mr. McGrath and to Mr. Severson. And then
the quote I'm looking at is he's saying, and we were told, I think, not only by Dan, but also on a phone call with Mr. Scott French. And I suppose the record will clear that up.
But
assuming that that's correct, and that really changes the analysis, doesn't it?
Your Honor, what's interesting about that conversation, I spoke about it in my reply brief, was that conversation is alleged to have occurred 1 year after Mr. Fumeno's already bought the security.
Is that clear? So there's no reliance? Is that what you...
That's what the record says, that conversation, he describes he's 1 year into it, is that conversation goes on to state that.
Okay, so but, then I think at that point we were about a year old. So
right.
Says we were. So you're saying that's Mr. Fumeno saying that he talked to Mr. French a year after he bought the security.
That's what he, that, yet the acknowledgement is that there's only one conversation. And see, my troubling part of the conversation, Justice Rice and other justices here, is the fact that we really have the best we get out of French.
Mr. Corey, I'm having trouble with that because you're saying there's one conversation.
Yes.
And you were talking there about the first answer, the good roads, fair weather type of conversation.
Yes.
And then in response to Justice Rice's questions about the Fumeno's description of a conversation with French regarding the affiliates breaking even, are you saying that's a separate conversation? Or does this argument that the conversation occurred a year after the investment was made apply also to the part of the conversation that you introduced initially in talking about the good roads, fair weather comments?
From the record, Justice Martinez, it's the same conversation. What I did in my brief...
So according to your argument, the entire conversation is not relevant to this offense because it occurred too late.
And exactly. And what's interesting about this, if I could, by my argument, I covered this in my reply brief. When I first of all prepared my opening brief, I was looking at the contents of a particular part of the record early on in Mr. Fumeno's testimony about his discussions with Mr. French in the context of Mr. McGrath, all the discussions they had, and then what Mr. French is alleged to have said about good roads, fair type of weather. I then got the additional information from the Attorney General's office about this additional transcript reference. I actually came to the court, I pulled the volumes out, I dug in, I found it. I then went ahead and analyzed it in my reply brief. Makes it absolutely clear in the comment that Justice Rice is talking about in the record that what Mr. Fumeno was talking about there is the same single conversation. Because the way the context is I had one conversation with French. The original conversation I understood to be the reference to the fair weather. I took it in the context of the sale. I further look at the record, which I cover in my reply brief, indicates that same, it's a single conversation, appeared to be when Mr. Fumeno was 1 year into the deal. So my frustration with this, in fairness, is once again, at best case scenario, I know there's an indirect issue, and I know it's a broad concept, Your Honors, but once again, we have the box, and we have all the evidence that shows the sale was made by Mr. McGrath, and we have Mr. French with this one little sliver, and I suggest to the court that we're stretching the box to include Mr. French with that. Now, I just have a minute. I was going to save some time for rebuttal, but I didn't do that. I wanted to answer the court's questions, but I just have one quick thing to comment about the restitution. One of the interesting parts about Colorado law is the restitution statute is a very good statute. It's a very important statute. People should be able to get restitution when they've been a victim of a crime. Mr. French was essentially charged with a restitution order requiring him to pay everything that any Colorado investor had put money into that was related to the two ISOs that he was alleged to be a manager on. Once again, though, in the record, there's no nexus to Mr. French causing damage, even if convicted, to anybody other than Mr. Fomento. And the record was that Mr. Fomento was paid. He had already been made whole. My argument to the court was an alternative one. I said to the trial court, I said, Your Honor, what we have is a situation where Mr. Fomento has been paid, but if there's any restitution, it should be the $8,000 to $10,000. It can't be the $435. There's just no nexus. Anyway, I'm out of time, Your Honors. Thank you very much.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Jennifer Berman, registration number 35882, and I represent the people, the respondents in this matter. This case is about control, and just like other white-collar crimes, it's about holding accountable the people who are in control of the fraudulent enterprise. And here, Kids Time was a fraudulent enterprise, and Mr. Scott French was one of the people in control of that enterprise because he owned and controlled an independent sales office whose sole purpose was to sell the partnership units to investors into the Kids Time enterprise, whose sole means of profit was to sell those partnership units. And the means by which they sold them was to send all potential investors the green brochure, which had material misrepresentations about the security status of the organization, the profitability.
Ms. Yes. Berman, I'm sorry. I have a little trouble hearing you, and I'm sorry.
I'm sorry.
But could you elaborate a little bit on what the evidence was of his control? I understand he owned it and all that. But what specifically were his responsibilities, what the evidence was about his responsibilities and his connection with the salespeople?
Could you, as long as you're into that question, my question was, what about his ownership? Because the defense counsel portrayed him as being the office manager, period.
Right. And that's a good question. If you look at Exhibit 51, I believe it is, it shows all of the employees and what are dubbed managers of each and every independent sales office. And what you'll see for that is nobody has claimed to be an owner. Each and every person at the top of those organizations is labeled a manager. So first of all, I think they're using the term manager loosely and just not using the term owner. But evidence of his ownership comes from testimony from Kenneth King, who is one of the co-founders of the Kids Time Enterprise, who said that Scott French told him personally, I own Pacific Ventures Incorporated, one of the independent sales offices. And also there's evidence from Scott Severson, who was one of the co-founders as well, referring to Scott French's office. If you look also at Exhibits 225 and 228, those are contracts that were entered into between Capital Funding, which manages the Kids Time Enterprise, and Pacific Ventures Incorporated, Mr. French's independent sales office. And Mr. French signed on behalf of Pacific Ventures Incorporated. And from that, it's a reasonable inference that he owned the corporation because he was able to contractually bind it. And a jury could have reasonably found that he, in fact, owned and controlled that corporation.
What was the evidence of his control over the salesman?
Well, honestly, I don't know that there was direct evidence of that, but again, he was the owner of that corporation, and he was the person that, one example would be Scott Severson found out that Pacific Ventures Incorporated salespeople were using unauthorized scripts. And he contacted Scott French about that, and he said, we need to do something about that. We need to get them back on track and not using these unauthorized scripts. And it was Scott French himself who obtained all of those inappropriate scripts and helped Severson out. And so you get the idea that he was in control of them. He had the ability to get them back on track. And he was the person who negotiated their contracts, their commissions contracts, which is their only means of making money. I mean, that was the way in which the salespeople at the independent sales offices made their profit.
Could I just ask you a question, if I may? I want to take you specifically to the computer.
Absolutely.
And specifically the language, make use of the resources of a computer or a computer system.
Mm-hmm.
And at the very least, we can agree. Well, let me preface this. A lot of the problem I'm having here is that so much of this case and the briefing and whatnot is in the passive voice. A computer was used, something was printed, that kind of language, as opposed to so-and-so used the computer, so-and-so printed something.
Right.
All right, so using like the active voice, what did Mr. French do to use the resources of this computer? What did he actually do?
Mr. French controlled an organization who utilized the green brochure, which everyone conceded was made on a computer. It was a resource of a computer.
But he didn't make the green brochure.
He did not make the green brochure.
He didn't print the green brochure.
He didn't print the green brochure.
Somehow the but green he brochure made use got into his hands. And he used
he and he his salespeople.
Right?
I apologize? What?
Somehow the green brochure got into his hands and then he gave it to other people and hoped that they would rely on it.
I don't know that he ever physically touched the green brochure, but he owned a sales office which consisted of salespeople who would request the green brochure be sent to potential investors, to every potential investor. And someone at Capital Funding would go into the computer and would probably print a lot of them at once, but would send it out to those investors. And there was evidence from Sean Barr, who is the office manager at Capital Funding, that while the salespeople would originally request the green brochure by fax, they eventually started requesting it by the computer itself, utilizing an email system. There was evidence that Scott French himself sold Kids Time Partnerships. We get that from Severson, who testified.
Well, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I guess I have something specific in mind. So let me come at it from the opposite end.
Okay.
How would somebody who ever used a piece of paper, you know, you can't print even a piece of paper without it going through some kind of computer these days. Printers are basically computers. So how would somebody who ever used in any way a piece of paper in a crime not be guilty of computer fraud? Under your theory?
Well, first of all, it's not just the using of the computer that constitutes the crime. It's all of the elements. You have to act knowingly in using the computer. You have
well,
to do
I mean,
it
well,
to
let's
obtain
just
money.
Focus on the piece of paper
right.
which came from the computer.
Okay.
So I'm a crook. I have all these people do these various things. Piece of paper results. Somehow that piece of paper is used in the crime. Am I guilty of computer crime?
Did you knowingly use that piece of paper, which we agree was created on a computer?
I knew I used that piece
and used
of paper
it to obtain
to
money.
Create a crime, but I didn't know that it came from a computer.
You didn't know it came from a computer.
No way.
I think in this case, it's not reasonable to say he didn't know it came from a computer. It was this shiny computer-generated, graphically designed brochure. And then there were also other documents created on the computer, such as the commission contract,
well,
which he signed.
I guess my point is these days, virtually no piece of paper comes from any place but a computer. So where do we draw this line? I mean,
I think
I just didn't think I was guilty of computer crime. I just thought I was doing a good old garden variety fraud.
Well, I don't think you have to know that which crime specifically you're committing in order to be liable for that crime.
But don't we as the legislature and the courts have to inform people of what the crime is so that you can conform your conduct, act in such a way so as not to commit a crime?
We do, and there's a few ways I would like to answer that. First of all, that's not the issue before this court. The issue before this court is whether there was sufficient evidence in this case of computer crime. And going into the issue of whether the citizens are sufficiently made aware of whether certain...
Let's just go back to that point. I don't want to dominate your time, but what specifically was the evidence of computer crime?
There was evidence of computer crime against the organization as a whole. The organization used computers throughout, from the beginning, to create these resources that were sent to the potential investors. The independent sales offices used the computers by making use of the resources. They requested the green brochures in order to get investments. The defendant himself entered into commissions contracts in order to make a profit from the enterprise. And that's how computers were used. That's how...
Ms. Berman, isn't a lot of that irrelevant because he was acquitted of the course of business fraud charge? And so we're really only talking about the specific securities fraud count that he was convicted of?
No, I don't think it is irrelevant because it's a different charge, securities fraud, course of business, and computer crime. The one is not based on the other.
Well, one requires a crime, a fraud, fraudulent scheme, right? The computer crime.
Right. It is, I believe this was probably charged on the basis of obtaining money through fraudulent representations, promises. But that's different than course of business, which is a jury determining that there's this entire scheme, this entire artifice, and the enterprise as a whole.
Well, isn't that exactly the same answer that you gave Justice Rice, that the computer was used to generate an entire...
I think that the same evidence can be used for both, but they're not the same. The acquittal of one does not require the dismissal or acquittal of the other.
Well, what happened more then to a support of a conviction of the computer crime and to not be sufficient to be the other?
I wouldn't agree that there was not sufficient evidence to support course of business. I don't know why the jury...
We have to accept that there wasn't, right?
We have to accept that that's what the jury, in this case, determined.
So what's the difference?
You know, the difference?
We have insufficient evidence for one crime, and here we have sufficient for the other. So what's in that middle?
I think it's the fact of how the computers were used and how integral they were to this enterprise. You have to look back at when this was. This was 1996.
Let's see, once again, you're speaking. What actually did he do actively?
The evidence that we have is that he owned the organization, that as a whole, the organization as a whole made extensive use of the resources of the computer, would not have been able to make profits without using the computer to create the green brochure, to create its commission contracts, and later on during the enterprise to request the green brochure be sent out to potential investors because those requests were made via email.
Counsel, can I just stop you there then? So basically, correct me if I'm wrong, but you're saying the organization as a whole used computers. There doesn't seem to be any question about that. And you have to draw an inference that because the defendant here was on top of that organization somehow, because of his position or his ownership, and that's the part I want to fill in. He must have known, he told them to do what they were doing. I mean, help me make that link there, because I think that's the problem.
Right.
Potentially.
And that's what the prosecution's evidence was, that because the organization as a whole was using computers so extensively and is such an integral part of the enterprise, that the defendant who owned an independent sales office whose sole purpose was to sell these partnership units, and that his control of that enterprise, his connection to capital funding, the management of the Kids Time enterprise, that it was appropriate for the jury to make a reasonable inference that he knew computers were being used. And of course, there's the evidence that he did obtain money and that it was all done through fraudulent representations because the green brochure itself was full of fraudulent representations. Thank you. Thank you.
Could you respond to Justice Rice's argument that it's basically impossible to to conduct any kind of business, whether it's legitimate or illegitimate, without the use of computers? So that would that make any business that engages in fraud also commit that the owner of a business commit computer crime as well?
Yes. I think that's where other cases that were cited in the Robb case can be helpful. I generally disagree with their analysis, but if you look at their analysis, especially the Jemison case, it points out that you can't get a conviction in that case because computers were not integral to the crime. They were merely a passive, what was the terminology? They were just something that, they were incidental to the crime itself. But I think here the computers were integral to the crime because this enterprise could not have existed. It could not have sought out investors from throughout the country and induced them to make these $10,000 investments without the use of computers. It added a certain legitimacy to their enterprise, which maybe nowadays, I mean, computer use is so widespread, maybe that distinction isn't as relevant, but I think back then it really was. I mean, it gave credibility to the enterprise.
You said to look at the Robb case?
I said to look at the Jemison case cited in the Robb case for the purpose.
Robb is the co-defendant.
Robb is the co-defendant.
So the evidence should essentially be about the same, at least with respect to the use of the computers in this scheme.
Yes.
And in the Robb case, they found, the Court of Appeals held that there wasn't a computer crime. And here they said there was. And so given that it was the same evidence, what do we do with that?
We acknowledge the fact that Robb did not analyze the case under the theory that Robb made use of the resources of a computer. Robb looked at other cases in which the issue was, did the defendant input data into the computer? And based on that, the court in Robb determined we don't have evidence that he personally touched a computer. We don't have evidence that he did input data into the computer, and therefore we don't have the crime. But if you look at the statutory definition of to use, it's much broader than simply inputting data. And it includes making use of the resources of the computer. So Robb was not correctly decided because it did not analyze it under that theory. If there are no more questions on computer crime, I would like to move on to the securities fraud issue. First of all, just in response to the justice's questions to Mr. Corey, it is true that conspiracy was dismissed and that complicity was not instructed. However, Justice Coates, I think it was your question as to whether do we even need to instruct complicity in order to find sufficient evidence under that theory. I would argue that you don't, because you look at what a reasonable jury could have done and not specifically what this jury did in determining the sufficiency. And here there was theoretically evidence of complicity, and from that the jury could have been so instructed.
What was the evidence of complicity?
I knew you were going to ask that. I keep harping on the same things, but it's the defendant's ownership of this organization which is such an integral part of the enterprise. And here he is talking to Mr. Fomento and furthering the sale to Mr. Fomento by giving him background information on here's how the enterprise is doing, here's where we're going, here's what your investment can be used for. And that was aiding and abetting Dan McGrath in making that sale through fraudulent representations, which of course the fraudulent representations mainly came from the green brochure itself.
What about the timing? I thought I understood your opposing counsel to say that this all happened at least a year after the person purchased the shares.
Right. I would strongly disagree with that interpretation of the evidence. First of all, I'd like to note that to the extent that it raises any kind of inconsistency in the evidence, and I don't think it does, I think it's very straightforward, to the extent that it does, that's for the jury to decide. They make those kinds of fact-finding credibility determinations. But the statement that Mr. Fumento made was that, and again, he had one conversation with Mr. French, that's what he testified to, and that he had that conversation before he made his purchase of a partnership unit in the enterprise. And he said that in a phone call with Dan McGrath, and he believes also in one with French, he was told that the first affiliates were just breaking even. We were going to start making money, and I think at that point we were about a year old. I think you can interpret that the we is Dan McGrath and Scott French telling him that we, the Kids Time Enterprise, we, the affiliates that are in existence, the first affiliates. And that makes sense on the timeline because Mr. Fumento invested in 1997. The Kids Time Enterprise started in 1996. And so the affiliates, the very first affiliates, were about a year old. And to tell them that they were just breaking even was absolutely a misrepresentation because at that time, 20 of the affiliates in existence had no revenue whatsoever. The most revenue that any of them had was $39,000, and it was estimated that each affiliate took in about $500,000. So that's definitely not breaking even. The
can I just be clear? So, your statement in the brief that we refers to the business of Kidzheim, not his specific investment.
I believe so, because the context of his testimony is, here's what I was told before I made my investment. I spoke with Dan McGrath four or five times, and then I spoke with Scott French, and then I went to the Kids Time office and looked around and spoke with Scott Severson. That was the context of his statement. He never said, I talked to Scott French a year later after my affiliate had been in existence for a year. The theory under which there's the most evidence to show Scott French liable for securities fraud is that he omitted material facts. Because it is, everyone agrees that he had one conversation with Dan Fumento. And in that one conversation, he didn't tell him that Kids Time partnership units were a security. He didn't tell him that the profit projections in the green brochure were fraudulent. He didn't tell him that there were cease and desist letters from various states. I think there were six in existence at the time of Fumento's investment. And he didn't tell him that Dan McGrath, the salesperson, would be making 50% commission off of his investment. And he had an obligation to tell him that.
Could I ask a question? With regard to, I couldn't tell exactly in the briefing, and I haven't looked at the record on it. How was the jury instructed with regard to their obligation of finding what French knew or had to know or had to intend with regard to any fraudulent activity or false statements?
I'm afraid I don't know the answer to that question. I don't recall the specific jury instructions.
Well, let's go back to the statute then. What do you take? Is there any kind of a culpable mental state required here? Do you take this to be a strict liability offense, one for which one can be vicariously liable?
It's willfully, which the case law has interpreted as the same as knowingly. Mm-hmm. And so he has to be shown to knowingly make these misrepresentations or knowingly omit material facts. And here, he absolutely had to know that the 12% sales commission listed in the green brochure was wrong because he himself had negotiated a 45 to 50% sales commission for all of his salespeople. He absolutely had to know that the statement in the green brochure stating that no state had taken any action or made any determination about these partnership units, he had to know that was false.
And so the jury was presumably instructed this, and they made a finding based on this evidence that he did know that these statements in the green brochure were false.
Yes. They were instructed on the mental state, I can tell you that much.
Can I ask you a bigger question about this?
Yes.
Let's say we might agree with your opponent on the computer crime, vacate that, direct that conviction be vacated, but agree with you on the securities fraud with Mr. Fomentos. What does that do to a restitution?
That would make it possible for you to look at the record to determine if restitution can be supported by the securities fraud course of business count, which was he was acquitted of, or the Coke account, which was dismissed after the jury hung, because the only determination that's required for restitution is whether his proximate cause of the victim's losses was proven by a preponderance of the evidence, not beyond a reasonable doubt. Or alternatively, if this court is uncomfortable making that determination, it can remand to the trial court to have a hearing to make those findings.
I know the trial judge issued a written ruling, but did he take evidence in support of the restitution?
Yes, there was a hearing and an investigator testified mainly about determining who was a victim of Scott French's conduct by means of who invested through Pacific Ventures Incorporated, his independent sales office. And what's interesting about that is that that determination of who or who is or who is not a victim, who constitutes the class of victim, that was actually injected by the defendant himself. The people originally asked that all Colorado investors be jointly, that all three defendants be jointly and severally liable to all Colorado investors into the enterprise. And French is the one who injected that at least theoretically he should only be liable to those investors who went through his organization. And that's exactly what they had a hearing to determine, who were those investors, and that is what the trial court's restitution order reflects.
And in response to Justice Coates' questions on the intent, it seems to me that the intent for securities fraud for the conviction now, just that, doesn't that require a specific intent to omit a misrepresentation in this telephone call that they had with Mr. Fomentos?
No, the statute doesn't require specific intent. It requires willfully, knowing.
I'm sorry, knowingly, willfully. I'm sorry, I didn't mean specific intent. But it does require, I guess I'm not after the knowingly part. I'm after the part it requires that he had to know at the time he made the statement. That's what we're talking about, right? He omitted this statement.
Right. He had to know that he was omitting material facts.
To Fomentos when he had the conversation, right?
Yes.
It's not the bigger picture at this point for the criminal conviction, right?
For the securities fraud?
Yes.
No. Yeah, it's at that time. But there's also other theories under which he can be found liable.
Right. I'm talking now about restitution.
Okay.
Let me see if I understand what you're saying about the $400,000 in restitution for the Colorado victims of the consumer of the fraud that came through his office. Is that tied to using the computer system for a fraudulent scheme, or is it tied to the securities fraud with regard to one count, or is it tied to both crimes?
It's tied to the computer crime count.
Okay.
It could be tied to securities fraud course of business as well.
But if it were just tied to the securities...
Securities fraud untrue
count,
statements...
it would be $10,000 to Fomento, right?
It would be $10,000 to Mr. Fomento and $8,000 to a James Anderson, which the defendant was, I believe that count was dismissed, but of course the trial court could have found that there was still a preponderance of the evidence demonstrating.
Does it make any difference that Fomento was paid through some other source or defendant?
I don't believe in the statute it does. I think the only thing that makes a difference is if the victim is paid in another way by the defendant himself. So for instance, if there were a civil action in which the defendant ended up paying the victim, you would reduce the restitution amount by that amount, but I don't think the victim's payment by other entities matters.
Okay, I'm just trying to figure out whether a victim can get doubly compensated under this scheme, or what specific finding the court might have to make about the payment by this defendant of the restitution amount. I don't quite understand how it works.
Right. I'm not exactly sure myself. I know that a lot of victims are compensated through the the Crime Victim Compensation Board. It may be called something slightly different. And then the restitution money would in fact go to the board, because the victim has been compensated in restitution, essentially. And that money that the defendant specifically pays in restitution would go to the board. Okay. That's my understanding.
And how about this $400,000? How would that get distributed to the group of Colorado victims?
An officer of the judicial department of the district would determine how the restitution is to be apportioned among the victims based on their actual losses, so the amount of money that they invested into the enterprise. If there are no more questions on this, I would ask that you affirm the Court of Appeals decision. Thank you.
On behalf of the court, I want to thank both counsel for your arguments. The case stands submitted.